From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar, and Happy New Year from all of us at CPR. We begin this report in Iran, where protesters have called on the government to resolve a number of economic grievances. Some of the protests have turned violent, resulting in at least 10 fatalities as of late Tuesday, including a member of security forces who was killed. Iranian officials say the U.S. and Israel are the main orchestrators of the unrest. Press TV's Mohsen Jalili produced this report from Tehran, the Iranian capital, which was narrated by Taha Imani.
The protests began on Thursday in some cities, including Mashhad and the capital Tehran, over economic conditions. The protesters chanted slogans against rising prices, unemployment, and economic inequality. They also expressed their anger at some political factions, which they blame for the current situation. But the rallies turned violent in some places, with some protesters damaging public property. On Monday, U.S. President Donald Trump posted fresh tweets in support of the unrest and called for change in Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also wished success for the protesters. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the acts of violence are provoked by Iran's enemies, including Israel and the U.S. He said any criticism of the government should be made through lawful means. Meanwhile, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says some foreign countries are using social media and the internet to wage a media war against the Iranian nation. Ali Shamkhani accused the U.S., Britain and Saudi Arabia of being behind the protests, but emphasized that the unrest will end soon. Iran's intelligence ministry has said some of the people who instigated the riots have been arrested. Meanwhile, Iranians have taken to the streets across the country to condemn the rioting.
Those who are causing sedition are foreign puppets whose strings are being pulled from abroad. Unfortunately, some others fall into their trap and do things that neither serves the interests of the nation nor the establishment.
On Monday, most cities which were hit by protests remained relatively calm. It seems the public support for the protests is waning, as the role of Iran's longtime enemies in stoking unrest in the Islamic Republic becomes more evident. Some analysts believe that foreign-based anti-Iran groups are also responsible for fueling the violence.
And one such analyst is Professor Mohammad Mirandi at the University of Tehran.
With the support of foreign entities through social media apps, such as Telegram, groups in Telegram, they began to promote violence. And even some groups began to teach people how to make Molotov cocktails.
By the standard that the U.S. has applied in the Russiagate narrative here, the actions being taken in plain view by both Washington and Tel Aviv clearly raised the question of U.S. and Israeli meddling in the internal affairs of the Islamic Republic. And as RT's Jacqueline Vuga points out, some of those chickens are coming home to roost for Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu.
The conflict has now spread beyond Iran's borders, as international powers give their two cents. Donald Trump unleashed a stream of tweets on the issue, accusing the Islamic Republic of corruption, human rights violations, and squandering the nation's wealth on sponsoring terrorism. Hassan Rouhani hit back at his American counterpart, saying Washington has no right to act as if it sympathizes with Iranians, when Trump not long ago called their country a nation of terrorists.
Iran, a terrorist nation like few others.
But if you look closely, Trump has ever so slightly adjusted his rhetoric. He shifted the blame solely on the government while calling for change. Of course, we've known for quite a while what kind of change the Trump administration would like to see in Iran.
Our policy towards Iran is to push back on this hegemony, contain their ability to develop, obviously, nuclear weapons, and to work towards support of those elements inside of Iran that would lead to a peaceful transition of that government. Those elements are there, certainly as we know.
So Trump may be hoping these protests will be the perfect opportunity to achieve just that. But he's not the only one chiming in. The Israeli government has voiced encouragement for the anti-government protests.
Brave Iranians are pouring into the streets. They seek freedom. They seek justice. They seek the basic liberties that have been denied to them for decades. And when this regime finally falls, and one day it will, Iranians and Israelis will be great friends once again. I wish the Iranian people success in their noble quest for freedom.
And what's even more surprising is what's happening on his own doorstep. Sunday saw thousands gather in Tel Aviv for a fifth week of anti-government corruption demonstrations. Just last week, over 10,000 protested throughout Israel. Yet the media and Trump have all but ignored them.
The Israeli, probably they're working very hard with the American to destabilize and to counter Iran. And basically, the decision has been very clear and vocal by the Israeli. They want the United States to actually attack Iran militarily. So if they can use some incitement, they will do, but they know they can leave it to the United States to do the work on behalf of them in the end.
Backing protests abroad but ignoring mass demonstrations in your and your allies' backyards, it may be a new year, but good luck waiting for a new approach from the U.S. or Israel on that.
We'll be watching events as they unfold in Iran very closely, and we'll be bringing you the reports from our people on the ground in the Islamic Republic. Kim Jong-un, the leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, issued a statement marking the Western New Year. He directed his comments at the world, and in particular, at observers in Washington.
The entire United States is within range of our nuclear weapons, and the nuclear button is always on my desk. This is reality, not a threat. The United States will never be able to start a war against me and our country.
Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
Kim Jong-un said the entire U.S. is within range of North Korean nuclear weapons. Kim announced that the country completed nuclear force in 2017. The North Korean leader also said that operational deployment of nuclear warheads and ballistic missiles will be Pyongyang's main focus. The U.S. and North Korea have been at loggerheads following Pyongyang's recent nuclear and missile tests. The North says it will not relinquish its nuclear deterrence and missile capability unless Washington and its regional allies end their hostile policy toward the East Asian country.
Frank Smith is a political analyst with Press TV.
His comments come somewhat expected. He had said several times in 2017 that the country had achieved its goals of developing a nuclear weapon system that can reach the United States and appears to have done that. There are some experts that believe North Korea still needs to develop re-entry capability and guidance capability in order to have a reliable intercontinental ballistic missile that can strike the United States. However, the nuclear test of September 3rd and the most recent missile launch of November 29th of 2017 indicate North Korea has, for all intents and purposes, developed the ability to reach the United States with a nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missile.
Another world leader who addressed the global situation for the new year was Russia's President Vladimir Putin, who issued the following statement to mark the beginning of 2018.
Дорогие друзья,
dear friends, 2018 is just around the corner. We celebrate the holiday every year, but every time we see in it something new, something kind. So we welcome it. We believe that everything we wish for in this moment, all of our hopes and dreams, will come true. For us, the New Year is, above all, a family holiday. We celebrate it in the same way we used to when we were children. It is a day of gifts and surprises, a day of warmth and affection, a day when we expect change, and change will surely come. If everyone remembers their parents, looks after them, and treasures each and every moment they spend with them. If we try to understand our children, recognize their dreams and aspirations, support those around us who need our help, and depend on our generosity. By supporting others, being thoughtful, and giving others our love and kindness, we make our lives truly meaningful. No matter where you celebrate this new year, at the family table, at a party, or in the streets, we are all united by common holiday cheer. And modern technologies allow us to share our feelings with those dear to us, even if they are hundreds of miles away. As always, I would like to say some special words to those who are working right now, performing their military or professional duty. People on night shifts in hospitals, train drivers and pilots. On this wonderful New Year's Eve, we are all together. We are together in our everyday lives too. Unity, friendship, and unconditional love towards Russia gives us the strength to be decent people and achieve great things. I want to give my heartfelt thanks to all of you for believing in yourselves and in our country, for your efforts and achievements. Let there always be trust and understanding between us. Dear friends, we're just seconds away from the start of the new year. Now is the time to express our most sincere feelings to one another. It is time to let go of mistakes and grudges, embrace one another, say words of love, surround your nearest and dearest with care and attention. Let the new year bring positive change to every person and every family. Let everyone be healthy. Let children be born and let them bring joy into our lives. Happiness and well-being to every one of you. Peace and prosperity to our great homeland, to our beloved Russia. All the best to you. Happy New Year 2018.
And of course, we couldn't close out 2017 discussing Russia without discussing Russiagate. Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Radio spoke with Ajamu Baraka, who was the vice presidential candidate of the Green Party in 2016, about all of that.
Jill Stein, the Green Party's 2016 presidential candidate, has been targeted for investigation by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The committee suggesting sinister motives for Stein's attendance at a dinner hosted by the popular Russian news site RT. Democrats, corporate media, and U.S. spy agencies have attempted to demonize RT for its practice of interviewing independent U.S. political parties and human rights advocates. Ajamu Baraka was Jill Stein's running mate on the Green Party ticket. We asked Baraka if the Greens had anticipated getting caught up in the anti-Russian hysteria.
Well, you know, Glenn, we did see that possibility quite some time ago, where it became quite clear that the investigation was striking out in various directions because the core of it was so weak. And we knew that on the Senate committee, there were a number of Democrats, of course, who were driving this so-called investigation, who wanted to use the investigation to address all of their political objectives. And one, I think, very important political objective was to undermine and smear any third-party attempts that could impact their ability to mobilize the vote in 2018 and in 2020. So the smear of the allegation that somehow Jill Stein and by extension the Stein-Baraka campaign were in some way colluding with the Russians is a very effective weapon, one that we've seen deployed during the first McCarthy era witch hunts back in the 1950s, where you basically end up on the defensive just as a consequence of the allegation. So we weren't surprised. We knew a few weeks ago before it became public that there was going to be that very strong possibility. And so when it became public, Jill was then sort of freed up to begin to address the allegations directly.
Yes, the CIA report that alleges Russian meddling in the U.S. political system focuses on RT, the news agency, and although it produces no smoking gun, but what it basically says is that RT is engaged in a campaign against the U.S. political system by, for example, covering Black Lives Matter and giving coverage to third-party candidates like you and Jill Stein.
Exactly. Most of the allegations of supposed collusion was based on a political assessment that suggested that if the campaign was taking certain political positions that seemed to be closely connected to positions that were articulated by various commentators who appear on the RT network, then that was supposed to be an example of the kind of ideological collusion that was taking place between the campaign and RT. But many people around the world see RT as a respectable outlet in the same vein as a BBC and any other of those media outlets that have a connection to public resources of their particular state. And while we know that RT has a variety of voices that appear on that show, on that channel, we know that there are a number of individuals who have credibility and respect from the progressive and radical community that also end up on that channel. And therefore, the notion that it is just some type of mouthpiece for the Russian state, I think it's not only silly, but it's dangerous. But it's something that's been used by the corporate sector and the state. Because, Glenn, the issue is not even RT. And I've been engaged in a conversation with a number of so-called leftists in the U.S. on this very issue. The issue is not RT. It is using RT as an entry point to reduce the range of information and analysis that's available to not only the public in the U.S., but to the global public. And we're seeing this collusion between the state and the corporate sector, a collusion that I think is more threatening than anything that the Senate investigation may be coming up with, in which they have decided that they're going to attempt to bury radical information, radical analysis, by burying the outlet that those analysis and information appears on. And we've seen the result of that, that with Google deciding that they're going to change their algorithms to make it more difficult to access radical outlets, the same thing with Twitter accounts to determine which ones are acceptable to the public and which ones are not. We see a very troubling move toward a narrowing of information, a process that is really revealing the corporate ideological totalitarianism that has been strengthened as a consequence of this whole Russiagate issue and this new McCarthyism that is rapidly becoming normalized in this country, driven not by the political right necessarily, but driven by the other part of the political right that we don't always identify as the political right, and that is these neoliberal corporatist Democrats. This is the political right that I'm more concerned with, and this is the political right that sees the third party efforts of the Green Party as a threat to its continued grip on the politics of the working class in this country and their neoliberal standing.
Yes, we see much of the suppression of dissent coming from the Democratic Party, which is the home of much of that which calls itself the left in the United States.
Exactly, and it's a testament, or it reveals the rightist character of politics in this country, especially when you see that even so-called progressive and radical elements allow themselves to be completely manipulated by this sector of the bourgeoisie. The normalization of the argument that the way you counter the more dramatic and obvious lunatic right reflected in those rightist forces that showed up in Charlottesville is to then embrace and collaborate with the neoliberal right, and that is then projected as a progressive position. It just reveals the extent to which politics in the U.S. is, in fact, an impoverished politics, and it reflects the absolute necessity then for those of us who are committed to building independent politics to basically disengage ourselves from this game, disengage and separate ourselves from the politics of the lesser of two evilism. It means building an alternative politics with alternative structures, with the objective of building a popular power and understanding that that process is a projected process that cannot be reduced just to the electoral cycles. And it means also, too, that while we may engage in the electoral arena, we understand completely that we're not going to vote ourselves to liberation, that any participation in the electoral arena is mainly a strategic or tactical kind of question, that we've got to be building these structures of dual power. And the bourgeoisie understands that. That's why they're trying to preempt that kind of movement toward really building viable independent politics. And that's why it's really unfortunate that leftist forces in the U.S. are so short-sighted that they don't understand the long-term objectives and have allowed themselves to be incorporated into the politics of the Democratic Party and are getting themselves placed where they are going to be again in 2018 and especially in 2020, involved once again in the lesser of two evilism, where basically we are forced to make a decision between those two representatives of the duopoly.
Yes, we're in need of a reconstruction of the left here in the United States, and to make it clear that nothing is genuinely left that is not also anti-imperialist.
Exactly, and that anti-imperialist thrust is something that I think would differentiate the politics on the so-called left as it relates to whatever electoral representative that one might be considering. That basically what defines one as a authentic left element is one in which you are in solidarity with the people of the world. That not only are you a concern about oppression in the U.S., you are concerned about the global structures of oppression. And you recognize then that one of the major instruments being used to evoke and to impose suffering on the peoples of the world is, in fact, the U.S. state. And it is, in fact, the use of the U.S. state's military and intelligence agencies to undermine democracy, to impose war and repression on peoples around the world. So basically, if you're not an anti-imperialist, you're not forthrightly opposing the U.S. state and militarism and war and imperialism, then basically you cannot, in my mind, twist up your mouth and call yourself a revolutionary or call yourself a so-called radical. You are, in fact, nothing but a class collaborator. And so that's where we are today, and that's why it's important for us to draw these lines of demarcation. It's important for people who really believe in democratic rights to be opposed to the move being made by the Senate committee to investigate the Stein-Baraka campaign, to use Russiagate to narrow the base of political discourse and information in this country. It's time for those forces to reveal themselves and for us to be able to organize ourselves to be able to resist the intensification of the repression that we know is coming in 2018 and beyond, because the state has no other options right now than to use force and repression because of its continuing decline in power and its legitimation crisis in this country. So the only thing they have now is continued and more intense repression. And the focus on the Stein-Baraka campaign is just one expression of their desperation.
And when we speak of the infrastructure of imperialism, the most dramatic expression of that is the vast network of U.S. bases, numbering, depending upon how you count them, as many as 1,000 across the world. There's going to be an important conference in Baltimore this month coming up, and you'll be part of it.
Exactly. Part of what we have to do as authentic radicals who stand in solidarity with the people of the world, who recognize that one cannot be concerned with domestic repression, police violence in the U.S., and not be in opposition to the violence being imposed on the peoples of the world, is that we have to build a viable, strong, effective anti-war, pro-peace movement that has an anti-imperialist character also. Part of what we are doing to, in fact, do that is we have put together the Black Alliance for Peace, along with a number of other organizations, have put together a coalition in which the focus right now for that this coalition is on this vast array of U.S. bases around the world. This notion that the U.S. cannot or should not be, is not seen as an empire, is absolutely ridiculous. When you look at the fact that here is a state that has bases, depending on how you define a base, between 800 and 1,000 around the world. And we say that if you're concerned about the global community, if you're concerned about repression, if you're concerned about human rights, then you have to join us to make it a demand that the U.S. close those bases, bring those troops back to the U.S., cease and desist from its subversion in these various countries, use that $150 billion that are used now to support those bases, to address the material needs of the people in the U.S. So we are coming together in January 12th, to, in fact, launch this No U.S. Foreign Bases campaign, where we are calling for the closure of these bases. The Black Alliance for Peace, we are going to focus even more intensely, though, on U.S. foreign bases in Africa. So we are going to be there. I'm one of the keynote speakers at that conference representing the Black Alliance for Peace. And we have a number of our actors who will be there in Baltimore. And we are using this campaign to, as the entry point, to raise the issue of the U.S. empire, to make the connection between what is happening on the African continent as a consequence of the intervention, the recolonization of Africa by the U.S. using military means, and the continued and intensifying repression by the domestic military that we call the police forces in our black and brown colonized spaces within the U.S. Those connections have to be made, and we've got to make those connections and build viable structures of resistance to address that objective reality of repression.
Well, how has the organizing been going for the Black Alliance for Peace? We had 8 years of the first black president who continued all of George Bush's wars and started a number of his own.
With the organizing, we've been in existence for just 7 months, and we are building a viable alliance of individuals and organizations. We have no money. We have no real staff. But we have a fierce determination to build this resistance, and we've been making significant inroads. We are still trying to address our material needs. We have a goal to try to raise resources by the end of this month to support our work with this campaign on U.S. foreign bases, and to bring our folks together for our first annual meeting of the membership in April. We launched April the 4th of last year to the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's resistance to the Vietnam War, and April will be our 1 year anniversary of the Black Alliance for Peace. So we're making progress because there's this vacuum there. There's this demand coming from the people who are looking for real alternatives. And for people who understand that we're not going to be able to build a viable anti-war movement without the full participation and, in fact, leadership coming from the black community. But we are galvanizing our forces. We are organizing our people to, in fact, take up that historic responsibility to provide that kind of input and that kind of leadership to the global head of the country. Our tagline is that we are a people-centered human rights project against war, repression, and imperialism. we make sure that people understand that we're not just about pro-peace. We're about pro-peace. But we understand that without justice, there could be no peace. And as long as you have imperialism, you cannot have justice. Therefore, we've got to struggle and fight for peace.
That was Green Party 2016 vice presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka, who's also an editor of Black Agenda Report.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.